Okay, so I'm very happy to be here at the Fields Institute. Thank you, Walter, for the invitation. So maybe you should turn some lights off. So first of all, I usually prefer a blackboard for giving lectures, but some of these theorems are a little bit long to write down, and I've got slides prepared already, so I guess it will be on the slides today. Is that visible to everyone? I'm not sure. Okay. Okay, that's... Okay. Okay, well, that looks better.
Yeah.
Okay, so so what I want to talk about today is Gauss curvature flow. So this is defined in the following way. So we have a given manifold, in this case it's going to be either the sphere or Euclidean space. And we think of it embedding that in some way into Euclidean space Rn plus 1. And then we want to flow these embeddings. We want them to evolve in a particular way. And the way X, capital X is the position vector, what we would like is to evolve by the so-called Gauss curvature flow, or in this case, I call it k to the alpha flow. So the position vector evolves with speed given by minus Gauss curvature to the power alpha, and then it evolves in the normal direction. Nu is the normal direction. So here I'm interested in convex surfaces, and I like to take nu is the outward unit normal, which is maybe not consistent with having positive Gauss curvature, but anyway, that's the way it's usually written, and that's why the minus sign is there. Okay, and I'm interested in surfaces which are convex. Right, I'll explain the reason for that. Alpha is a positive parameter. So the flow will have different behaviors depending on the value of alpha. And the typical sort of thing that happens, well, k is positive. There's a minus sign there. Nu. The Gauss curvature is, there are various definitions, but it's the product of the principal curvatures, or it's the determinant of it's intrinsic in even dimensions, and it's intrinsic up to sine in odd dimensions. Because if you change the normal, the principal curvatures change sine. So it's the Jacobian of the Gauss map. It's another way to look at it. This is all codimension one, yes. No, codimension one. And the typical behavior is like this. Well, it shrinks the surface, and if you start with something that's smooth, uniformly convex, typically what happens, it shrinks. As it shrinks, the shape changes in some way. And eventually what happens, in fact, if you start with any uniformly convex for any positive power, it always shrinks to a point in a finite time. And the question is, well, what happens along the way? And the typical sort of behavior is that it becomes more and more round as it shrinks. So if you rescale, say to keep the enclosed volume constant, then typically you expect the thing is getting more and more round. And at the final time, it becomes a a round sphere. That's a typical behavior. And that, for example, is known to happen also for the mean curvature flow. If you replace k to the alpha by the mean curvature, that's exactly what happens. It's a famous result of Gerhard-Huskin. Okay, now, so that's the first flow, k to the alpha flow. I will also talk about flow by a negative power. Oh, the reason there's a minus sign here, and the reason I look at convex hypersurfaces is that for Gauss curvature flow, you'll see a little later, this is basically a parabolic problem if you have the minus sign there, and and if you have a uniformly convex surface, so you can flow the thing. It's a parabolic problem. If you change the sign in general, it wouldn't be well defined. It would be a backward parabolic problem. I would also like to talk about flow by a negative power, and because now you have a negative power, it's appropriate here to keep it parabolic to take away the minus sign. Otherwise, again, you have a backward parabolic. So here we take away the minus sign. And what happens in this case, it's an expansion flow. So the surfaces move outwards. And if you rescale back to keep the enclosed volume constant, typically what happens is that they become spherical. In fact, that's known for all alpha, for k to the minus alpha flow, that's known to be true for all positive alpha, provided a solution exists. There are still some gaps in the existence theory for alpha bigger than 1. Bigger than 1 over n, sorry. So here's a summary of what's known about these. If m is compact, so in this case we've got embedding of the sphere, and so we've got a convex surface like this, sitting in R3, say. So this model originally, the first time Gauss curvature flow was introduced was by William Fiery about 30 years ago, and he proposed it as a model for the wearing of a stone, say, on a beach. It's sort of tumbled by the waves, and as it hits the beach, it sort of gets worn where it strikes the sand. And so he proposed this sort of model, Gauss curvature flow with alpha equal to 1, as a model for the wearing of the stone. And he didn't really prove very much about it. For example, he didn't have any existence results. All he really proved was that if you assume existence and uniqueness, and you assume the solution is centrally symmetric, so symmetric about the origin, then eventually it will become spherical, just before it shrinks to a point, or just as it shrinks to a point. But he didn't have any existence results. So the first existence result was by Kaiseng Chow, or Zhou, or Chow as he's now known, for alpha equal to 1. He showed you have a smooth solution for smooth uniformly convex initial surfaces, and the solutions shrink to a point in finite time. But he didn't show convergence to a sphere, and in general that's still an open problem. There's really only one case where, in the two-dimensional case, where that has been resolved. About the same year, Ben Chow looked at the case where you have the nth root of the Gauss curvature, and in this case he got the same result as Zhou, plus convergence to a sphere after rescaling. So this result, remember, Gauss curvature is the product of the curvatures, so if you take the nth root of this, there are n of these, you take the nth root, it looks more or less like the mean curvature. It has the same homogeneity. So Ben Chow's result is sort of an analog of Gerhard Huskin's result for the mean curvature. Exactly the same sort of behavior. And in general, you expect that. I think it's been proved for a large class of examples for flows which have the same homogeneity as the Gauss curvature to the 1 over n or the mean curvature. You get that sort of behavior. Okay, things a bit more interesting when you take some other powers of the Gauss curvature. Ben Andrews looked at the case alpha is 1 over n plus 2. That particular example is of interest in image processing. It's also of interest in geometry. The reason is that that flow is affine invariant. So if you make an affine transformation of the ambient space of Rn plus 1, and you compute how the flow changes under that affine transformation, you get back exactly the same flow. And because of that property, you can't expect that you're going to get spheres as asymptotic limits, but you get the next best thing, which are ellipsoids, which are spheres modified by an affine transformation. So you get the next best thing. Okay, a bit later. Well, of course, it's determined, but whether you can actually predict it in some way, I'm not sure. I don't know, actually. I can't answer that question. Possibly you can. Okay, so after 2 years later, or no, more like 4 years, Ben looked at other powers. So for alpha bigger than 1 over n plus 2, but less than or equal to 1 over n, he proved you get you get existence for a maximal time interval, convergence to spheres after rescaling. And interesting question is, what happens for other values of alpha? Well, one thing that is known is that for all positive alpha, you get convergence to a point. So these things shrink down to a point as the final time is approached. If the solution exists up to the final time, then it has to be a point. If you interpret solution in some sort of weak sense, viscosity sense, or something, then I think there are existence results for all alpha. But if you want smooth solutions, then there's still work to be done. It hasn't been solved completely. So what happens in general is that for small alpha, that means for alpha less than 1 over n plus 2, in general there's no limiting shape. These things can just evolve and they can get sort of long and thin, although they are getting smaller, but after rescaling they're getting long and thin. And in general there's no limiting shape. In fact, even worse, the isoperimetric ratio need not even stay bounded. There are examples to show that. Okay, but what is known is that if the isoperimetric ratio does stay bounded, then you do get convergence to something, and that something is a homothetic solution. So a homothetic solution is one that it doesn't change its basic shape, it just shrinks. Same shape, but just gets smaller. By homothetic, I always mean homothetic with respect to the origin. Okay, so if the isoperimetric ratio stays bounded, then you get convergence to a homothetic solution. So the question now is, well, what are the homothetic solutions? Well, certainly the spheres are homothetic solutions. They just shrink and stay round. For alpha equals 1 over n plus 2, ellipsoids are homothetic solutions. Ellipsoids centered at the origin. For alpha in this range here, between 1 over n plus 2 and 1 over n, the only things you get are spheres, the only homothetic solutions. But interesting things happen when you have small powers of alpha. In that case, what can happen is that there are homothetic solutions which are not spherical. Always in the convex case.
Yeah.
Codimension 1. So if n is 1, yes, there are self-intersecting, there are immersed solutions which are not. But here they're always, I'm always talking about embedded solutions. And yes. Okay, but as far as the embedded solutions go, there's a complete classification. Okay, and they look like this. So if you take any positive integer k, such that k squared minus 1 is less than 1 over alpha, then you have homothetic solutions. And they have this sort of... So for alpha like that, there's a homothetic solution with threefold symmetry. And there's another one with sort of fourfold symmetry. I mean, these pictures, maybe they don't look exactly like this, but the symmetries are like this. And all the way up to something with k-fold symmetry. So as alpha gets smaller, you get more and more of these solutions. As alpha approaches zero, the solutions start to look more and more like polygons. And as alpha increases up to one over k squared minus 1, they become more and more spherical. So that's what they look like in for n equals 1, for curves. In higher dimensions, n equals 2 and more, there are also non-spherical homothetic solutions for small enough alpha. But there's no known classification. There are examples known, there should be a lot more. The examples that are known also have a lot of symmetry. There's one that has tetrahedral symmetry, one that has octahedral symmetry, and so on. So they have a lot of symmetry, but it's not known whether that's all of them or whether a homothetic solution must have some sort of symmetry or not. Even in two dimensions, when n is 2, there's still a lot of open questions there. Okay, so that's the classification for n equals 1. Okay, what happens with flow by a negative power of the curvature? Well, in some respects, this is much better behaved because, you have existence for alpha between 0 and 1 over n. And what happens is that the surface just grows and grows and grows. If alpha is equal to 1 over n, it grows exponentially. If alpha is less, it grows at a polynomial rate. But what happens is that if you rescale back, they always become round. The existence is still, apparently, it's still an open problem with alpha bigger than 1 over n. I guess in the one-dimensional case it's known as well, but in general for n bigger than equal to 2 and alpha bigger than 1 over n, there's some PDE-type problems, which I don't have time to explain, which make existence a little bit tricky. But in any case, as long as you have a solution, it must become spherical. And that's because there's this estimate of Gulliver, of Chow and Gulliver, which tells you this quantity, the support function, inner product of the position vector and the normal, the oscillation of that doesn't grow. It stays bounded by some constant that depends only on the initial surface. So if you think about that, if x, these things are expanding out to infinity, if you rescale back to have a constant enclosed volume, you'll see that this difference has to go to zero after rescaling. That means it's converging to a sphere. Okay, so that's what's known for the compact case. So what I really want to talk about more today is the non-compact case. So in this case, the surface you're embedding is, the manifold you're embedding initially is Rn. So in this case, I'm interested in compact, complete, convex, non-compact embedded hypersurfaces. So what I mean by that is it's a boundary of some unbounded open set in Rn plus 1. That's what I mean. And the question is, classify the homothetic solutions in that class for both flows, the k to the alpha and k to the minus alpha flow. This problem is turns out to be rather different than the classification for compact surfaces. It turns out in this case you can classify all the homothetic solutions in that class. Yes, and I'll state the results in a minute. This is for n bigger than or equal to 2. So that's at least surfaces and higher dimensional things. There's also a complete classification for one dimensional, for curves, for embedded curves, and also for immersed curves, I guess. But it's a bit different, and the reason is that things in the case where n is at least 2, such a thing is basically essentially a graph. It may have some vertical pieces, but it's essentially a graph. If n is 1, you can have spirals and things like that. And there are spiral solutions as well. So the classification, although it's very interesting, it's different, and I won't talk about that today. Okay, so the first theorem is classification for k to the alpha flow. So that's, in the compact case, that's where they're shrinking down to a point. So suppose we have a surface that moves homothetically and non-trivially under k to the alpha flow for some positive alpha. Then it has to be one of the following. Either it's a hyperplane containing zero, or the origin, which is not very interesting, or there's this n plus 1 dimensional closed convex cone, C, in Rn, with vertex at the origin, not containing any straight lines, so that means it has a genuine sort of vertex. It's not a product of a lower dimensional cone with a some factors of R, such that M is contained in this cone and M is asymptotic to the boundary. So maybe I should draw a picture of this. So we have this cone. This is its boundary. The surface sits inside like this and it's asymptotic to the boundary. I'm allowing the possibility, when I say asymptotic, it's maybe not strictly the correct way to use it, I'm allowing the possibility that you do get touching, which is convenient to use that. And I have to allow that in general. That may occur. Well, it's a genuine cone. It's not a product of, a cone times R, so that it has a straight line. It has a real point. Yes. Right? So it really is a pointed cone. Okay? So it has to be asymptotic to one of those. And the converse is that given any such cone, any alpha positive, there is a surface M in this class which is asymptotic to the cone, and it moves homothetically under K to the alpha flow. And it's unique up to homothetes, up to scalings. Right? Here I've said it moves homothetically under K to the alpha flow, possibly interpreted in a generalized sense. What that covers is this sort of situation where you get touching. The surfaces will always be smooth inside the cone, but in the case where you have to add a piece of the cone to make it complete, you'll have at least C1 regularity across there, but it may not be C2. And so from a PDE point of view, you can't sort of say it satisfies it in the classical sense across that interface where it joins, but it does in a generalized sense. And it's always at least C1.
This is K alpha.
K alpha. Well, these are moving out, yes. They're sort of, what they call these things is, what do they call it? When there's a curve, they call it the curve coming out of the corner. As you go back in time, it's sort of getting back more like this. Well, of course, something that has zero Gauss curvature doesn't move. But they're not the interesting cases. And that's what I've included. I've said non-trivial. I haven't said what that means yet, but I'll come to that. So, well, one of the things is that it comes out in the proof. These things are always strictly convex inside, but not where it meets, where it touches. Right, it approaches the boundary. Now, it may do it like this. It may never meet it, just goes off to infinity in X. Or it may meet the boundary. And then from then on it coincides with it. Okay, so that's what they look like for K to the alpha flow. So they're all, their behaviors are all pretty much the same for all alpha. For flow by negative powers, the situation is a little bit more varied. First of all, if you have a surface in this class script C and it moves homothetically under K to the alpha flow, then first of all, it must be an entire graph of positive Gauss curvature. So you can't have something supported over a bounded domain like this. It really has to be an entire graph. A consequence of the fact that these things are complete convex surfaces is that the Gauss image is essentially convex in the sphere. In this case, the Gauss curvature is always positive, and the Gauss image will be an open subset. So, in fact, it's a geodesically convex open proper subset of the sphere. That's not part of my theorem, really. That's part of the structure theorem for complete convex surfaces in Euclidean space. But I include it here because it will sort of clarify something a bit further down. Okay, the second part of the theorem is if alpha is bigger than or equal to 1 over n, there are no homothetic solutions in that class C. And the last part is the existence part. For every alpha, strictly between 0 and 1 over n, and every geodesically convex open proper subset gamma of the sphere, you can find exactly one homothetic solution in C that moves homothetically under k to the minus alpha flow, and the Gauss image is given by gamma. And again, you have uniqueness up to scaling. So these solutions are completely classified or determined by their Gauss images. And there is exactly one for every possible allowable Gauss image. It's the class of complete embedded convex hypersurfaces in Rn plus 1. Complete non-compact. Okay, so there's exactly one up to scaling for each allowable Gauss image. That's why I stated this. Sorry? Yes, all these turn out to be strictly convex. They all have positive Gauss curvature. In fact, the flow, because it's flow by 1 over Gauss curvature, it doesn't really have any proper meaning for positive, for non-positive k. Okay, so that's the second theorem. And now I'll say something about the proofs. So, yes? Gamma is open. Yeah. So it could be the half hemisphere, yes. The southern hemisphere. So it's sort of, right. But it could be the whole southern hemisphere, so, or northern hemisphere, or any hemisphere you want. But open. No. Excluding the equator, open. Paraboloid is one example, actually, for, I think it's alpha equals 1 over n plus 2, you get the paraboloid. Yes, homogeneous. Yes? Yes. Is there scaling limits? Well, the problem I mentioned, the model for stones, they're geometric. People are interested for geometric reasons in this sort of thing. It comes up in affine geometry, for example. But I don't think, as far as I know, it doesn't have the same, doesn't come up, say, with mean curvatures. Flow, say, comes up from Alan Kahn equations, and doesn't. I don't think it has that sort of. That sort of connection. Okay, so now you go back to first year, and well, it's the usual separation of variables. Homothetic solutions, well, it's going to grow the original x0 times some function depending only on t. And you plug that in. You use here, well, the normal doesn't change under such a transformation. Gauss curvature scales like 1 over distance to the power n, so when you pull the phi out, you get that. And then it's separation of variables. You can solve the equation for phi. That's it there. And the equation for a homothetic solution is this. And so that's the equation we want to solve. So we've gone from something that has evolution, a parabolic equation, now to something where there's no time dependence. So it's a stationary problem. And we have to consider the three possible cases where lambda is either positive, negative, or zero. If lambda is zero, then phi is just a constant. So those in those examples, nothing moves. It just stays as it is. And that's what I call the trivial case. If that happens, the surface doesn't move at all. So the Gauss curvature must be zero. And surfaces, complete convex surfaces with zero Gauss curvature have been completely classified. They're basically, depending on the rank of the second fundamental form, they're products like this, products of a lower dimensional complete convex surface with the right number of factors of R. Okay, so that's the trivial case. So now we have to see what happens when lambda is positive or negative. If you look at this, you see that Gauss curvature and this x dot, the normal, they scale differently. So you can always rescale to make lambda plus or minus 1. So let's assume that normalization. And then the equation, if you let beta equal to 1 over alpha, when lambda is minus 1, you get this equation, k is x dot nu to the power beta. And you see what happens. Well, if k is a hyperplane, then the Gauss curvature is 0, and then x dot nu has to be 0, which means the plane must go through the origin. So the only planes you can get are planes through the origin. If it's not a plane, then Gauss curvature must be not, is in any case it's non-negative, but this equation puts a sign condition on the inner product of x and the normal. And that's geometric information. You see from this picture here, what it is, the position vector dotted with the normal is non-negative. That means that zero, the origin must lie in the convex region determined by the surface. So you draw the picture like this. The origin is, say, here. Then the position vector of a point, say, here. The normal is that. So this x dot nu is the perpendicular distance to the support of the tangent plane with outward normal nu. That's the geometric meaning of that. And if, say here, the origin is there, this distance here is bigger than or equal to the distance of the origin from the surface. Right? Because this is a point on the surface which is and so that distance is smaller than the distance from here to the origin. So you have this inequality. Now, if the origin is not on M, then there's a strict inequality here, strictly positive. In fact, you put some constant there. And then you just integrate this equation here, and you get a contradiction out of that. This is x dot nu is bounded from below by a positive constant, so here you pick up some positive multiple of the area. On the other hand, the integral of the Gauss curvature gives you the area of the Gauss image, and that is at most half of the sphere, half the area of the sphere. So you get a contradiction from here, because this is finite, this is infinite. You have to also deal with the case where the origin is sitting on the surface, somewhere like that. It's essentially the same sort of argument, but instead of doing this integration over all of M, you have to be a little bit careful and find an appropriate subset, but eventually you get a contradiction like this, with M replaced by another set. You get a bound like this on an appropriate subset, sort of lies in a wedge-shaped region. And so you get a contradiction in the same way. So the conclusion from that is that if lambda is equal to minus 1, the only solutions you have are the hyperplanes through the origin. Okay, they're not, there's nothing interesting. Okay, then you deal with the case where lambda is positive. In this case, the equation is this one here. And k is non-negative, that means that x dot nu must be less than or equal to 0, which means that the origin lies on the opposite side from m of any tangent plane. So the picture is something like this. The green curve is m. One of these could be a tangent plane, and the origin has to lie on the opposite side. Or in this case, it really lies on the curve, but that comes after. So again, you work out what that means. Well, if M happens to contain the origin, you can show that if it contains the origin, then and it does, it's not a plane. Then somewhere it must have a supporting plane or tangent plane which doesn't touch the origin, and that would mean that x dot nu would be strictly, well, you can't read that there, x dot nu, if the normal is here, would be strictly positive. And that gives you a contradiction, because we know it has to be negative, non-positive. So you rule out that case again by a simple geometric considerations. So what's left, is the only possibilities, non-trivial possibilities left, are that the origin is not in M, and you have this sort of setup. Every tangent plane lies between the origin and the surface. So in that case, you simply define the cone to be the intersection of all the closed half spaces, H, that contain the surface M and which have the origin on their boundaries. So another one. And so the intersection is a cone, basically. And that's what gives you the cone, right? It's the intersection of all these things. So now we've got the cone, and now it's really a matter of doing a little bit more work to check that it has all the properties I claimed. Well, that's some geometric considerations. I won't give you all these details. But once you know you've got this cone and you know it has no straight lines, you can make a rotation of coordinates. So this cone, the boundary is the graph of something, and psi is positive on Rn minus the origin. Okay, and then this surface then also has to be a graph, because it's asymptotic to this cone. So it also has to be a graph. Well, then you can work out what sort of equation does it satisfy. Well, the position vector is given x by xu. The normal, downward pointing normal, is given by that. The Gauss curvature is given by that expression. You throw all that together and plug it into the equation we had. K, the alpha, is minus x nu. And the PDE you get out is this one here, a Monge-Ampère type equation. The beta is 1 over alpha, gamma is some other number. And the boundary condition, well, the boundary condition, well, you see, this thing is asymptotic to the cone. In fact, so I haven't shown that yet, but that's something you can show. The boundary condition, or one way of stating the boundary condition, is in this way, where here, this cone psi, by deep psi, I really mean the sub-gradient map. So I'm allowing multivalued gradients here at the origin, right? And possibly elsewhere if it has, say, a corner in it. Okay, so that's interpreted in the usual sense of convex analysis, the multi-valued sense. And then you've got this PDE. Now you can do a little bit of work. It's not very difficult. You can show that U actually has to approach psi at infinity. So it is asymptotic. Okay, so that's that part. The existence part. Okay, the existence part basically is you have to solve this PDE, this nonlinear PDE. You've got this boundary condition here, that the two gradient images have to be the same, or the closures. Okay, so you're prescribing the gradient image of U to be a bounded convex set. Well, this has some difficulties. First of all, this term here is non-negative. It may be zero. In fact, it's zero where it coincides with the cone. And that's a problem from a PDE point of view, because this equation is elliptic on solutions with positive definite Hessian. Once you start getting the right-hand side going to zero, you've got something degenerate, and you have PDE problems. So you have to figure out what to do with that. So a solution to that problem, which works quite nicely, is to, instead of trying to find a solution on all of Rn, you look for a domain, omega, and a solution, and you require U to be a solution in the domain omega, and the domain omega is as large as you can make it while keeping U minus x dot du positive. Remember, x dot du, U minus x dot du is decreasing in radial directions. You differentiate that in the radial direction, you'll see that that's true. So this domain you get is a star-shaped domain. And, well, you make the domain as large as you can, so you want that positive. And as x, you approach the boundary of the domain, or you go to infinity in the domain, u minus x dot u goes to zero. So that's the boundary condition, or one boundary condition, and this is the other boundary condition, the prescribed gradient image. The gradient image is prescribed to be the gradient image of psi. And so what we've got now, we have to find the domain and the function u, but we've got two boundary conditions. It's a free boundary problem. And, well, this is a free boundary problem. In some ways, it looks like we haven't really made any progress because it's at least as bad as the other thing, but, in fact, it's a very nice free boundary problem, because if you take the Legendre transform of U star, which is given by this formula, the transformed function satisfies this equation on the fixed domain omega star with zero Dirichlet condition. And so what we've got now is a Dirichlet problem, one with zero Dirichlet condition, so the simplest boundary condition you can ask for. But what we've got in the equation is a singular part. This is blowing up as you go to the boundary. Okay, well, so now you want to show you can solve this for every convex domain and for every beta greater than zero. It turns out you can do that. You have to. The theorem that you need is not quite in the literature, but you can extract it and do a little bit more approximation. Usually, it's proved for reasonably smooth domains and so on. But you can extract it and do a little bit of extra work, and you can solve. You can show you can solve this problem, and then you just transform back, and that gives you the solution. Okay, how much time do I have left? 2 or 3 minutes, okay. Okay, so the proof of theorem 2, well, let me just sort of give, again, you go through the same sort of procedure, then there's some sort of geometric considerations to rule out, in this case, you have to rule out negative lambdas. Okay, so it's similar to what happened before. And then there's some geometric consideration to show that it must be an entire graph. And basically, the reason is you show that the origin has to be on this side of the graph. If it's becoming vertical, what's happening here is it's starting to look like a cylinder here. And something that looks like a cylinder there will has sort of this on this set here, x dot nu is going to be bounded away by some positive constant. And using that, you can get a contradiction. The same sort of way as we did before by integrating the equation. The Gauss image has finite area, on the other hand, something like that. This piece would have infinite area, and this is strictly positive on it. So if you integrate this equation, or strictly, so I guess it goes the other way. It's bounded by some constant, because it's looking like a cylinder. Okay, so the PDE you get in this case is this PDE. So the existence part. You've got this is the PDE you have to solve now. You want to find an entire solution of this, and you have to, the boundary condition is basically prescribed gradient image. The reason is that if you choose, so if this is the set gamma, you can choose the coordinates so it lies in the southern hemisphere. And then you project down onto the origin, onto a set down here, omega star is what I call that. And if you choose the coordinates appropriately, there are really only three types of omega stars. Either it's a bounded convex domain, or it's a product of a bounded convex domain with some factors of Rn, or it's all of Rn.
For Canada, can we do it in the northern?
Yes, in Canada you can do it into the northern hemisphere, yes. But in Australia we do things to the southern, in the southern hemisphere. And so you want to solve this PDE problem. You want to find an entire solution of that with prescribed gradient image. Okay. Well, what this boundary condition means really, when you have to do some work to check it properly, it means really that the gradient grows superlinearly, grows faster. The function grows superlinearly. The gradient has to go to infinity as you go to infinity. So how do you solve that? Well, again, this problem here, you've got this funny boundary condition. You make the Legendre transform. You get something on the domain omega star, which has these three possible structures, and you want to solve so that the gradient image of U star is all of Rn, which is another way of saying it has to grow super linearly. Right? So we want solutions that grow faster than linearly. Oh well, then you can solve that. And the reason you can solve it is when alpha is less than 1 over n, that is when beta is bigger than n, you can construct a subsolution and a supersolution with the property that the supersolution sits above the subsolution. Right? You've got the supersolution up here. You've got a subsolution below it, and then you find a solution in between the two, because they are separated like that. And it depends on explicitly building these sub and super solutions, and then you use a bunch of PDE theory, Monge-Ampère type theory to solve that. The existence you get for alpha less than 1 over n, you also need that condition for the uniqueness. And to rule out that there are no solutions if alpha is bigger than or equal to 1 over n. Okay, well, I guess that's pretty much, I've run out of time. Okay, thank you.